Welcome to the New in Chess podcast. My name is Remmelt Otten and I'm the publisher of New in Chess books. The New in Chess podcast has three pillars. My colleague Dirk-Jan ten Geuzendam interviews chess personalities for about an hour. And we have the wonderful stories of Kenda Sasanko, narrated by professional voice actor Nick Murphy, who happens to be a chess fan as well. And when you hear me, it's about a new book published by New in Chess. As always, the New in Chess podcast is available on Spotify, on Apple Podcast, and on Google Podcast. And of course, via our own website with the header podcast. Before we start, I'd like to thank our sponsor DGT, the Dutch company that creates clocks and electronic chess sets. When you've been following the candidates, the live games, it's all possible because of the electronic sets of DGT that record the moves and transfer them to the software and then out into the world. Wonderful stuff. So back to the interview. My guests today are Natasha Regan and Matt Boll. They wrote the book Tweetenzoek that focuses on the concept of the so-called in-between move or the intermezzo. And I'm really excited to hear from them. So without much further ado, please enjoy this week's episode of the New in Chess podcast. Natasha, how are you?
Yes, I'm very well, thank you, Remmelt. How are you?
Yeah, where are you staying at the moment?
I'm just outside of London, a town called Epsom that's famous for its racecourse.
For its racecourse, okay. Yes, that was my question. Why should we visit Epsom?
Yes, racecourse or bath salts.
Okay.
Epsom salts.
And have you lived there all your life, or?
No, I've lived there actually since my twin daughters were 1 year old, so lived there. They're 19 now, so I lived there for about 18 years.
Okay. And Matt, where are you from?
So I live in a city called St Albans, which is about 20 miles north of London.
Also close to London, okay. And yeah. How did the two of you meet?
We actually met many, many years ago when we were junior players. So we both were in the English county of Buckinghamshire, and we played school matches. So, or at least I went to a junior chess club, and Matt was at a local school. So we played lots of matches when we were about, I don't know, 12 years old or maybe slightly older than that. Yeah. So many, many years ago.
Okay. Well, now you have produced a book for us. It's also a chessable course. It's called Tweetenzoek. So the first question is obvious. Why give it the name Tweetenzoek when you can also choose something beautiful like intermezzo? The head Tweetenzoek is German and we need Jan Gustafsson for the pronunciation. So why this choice, Natasha?
I guess it's a nice word. That's kind of how I've known this tactical concept. So the concept of doing an intermediate move, I'm now shy of saying the word, but I've always known it as Tweetenzoek.
Yeah, no, sounds perfect.
Yeah. So I like the name. But throughout the book, then we use the terms intermezzo and intermediate move as well interchangeably.
Okay.
So we think it gives it this a kind of a drama, using that word,
Tweetenzoek. Yeah. And so your next book will be about Zugzwang.
Well, funnily enough, it's not a plan at the moment, but it has been suggested to us before.
Yeah.
So and then when we've done that, it'll be Zeitnot.
Zeitnot. Yeah, that's good. Okay. Matt, you were the first one who came up with the idea of this course. How did you discover the Tweetenzoek?
Well, I mean, there was a little kind of moment in time, but really from the outset, it's kind of a joint collaboration. But I was analyzing a game with a friend, Ray, and he just pointed out I wasn't looking for these in-between moves when I was analyzing. So I promised him I would teach the juniors at my chess club that I run all about intermediate moves. But I started discussing them with Natasha, and we felt there was a lot more to it than I could do justice in a few lessons in a chess club, which I did provide, but Natasha had lots of other ideas about where we could take this, and you know, she has experience from co-authoring a couple of books, including Game Changer with New in Chess, and before we knew it, we were discovering lots more about intermediate moves and realizing there might be a chessable course in it.
Yeah, and You're a national trainer. Can you explain how that's something that interests me? How do you qualify to become a national trainer? How does it work?
Yeah, so I have the FIDE coaching title, national instructor.
National instructor.
And okay. And you can gain a coaching title through doing a particular FIDE coaching course. Mm-hmm. The one I attended had lectures from kind of legendary coaches like Arthur Yusupov, Jakob Agard, Ivan Sokolov, and so on. And then you take a 2-hour written exam at the end of it, and you submit a CV of your coaching achievements. And based on how you do in the exam, the level of players you coach, your own chess achievements, you may be awarded a particular level of coaching title.
Okay, so there's even a possibility to go further. Or?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the top titles are things like FIDE Senior Trainer and so on.
Okay.
In time, I might be able to apply for promotion to higher levels and so on, but that would also be contingent on training some higher level players.
Okay, and so you're a coach and a trainer. Is that your full time job, or do you have other jobs as well?
Well, I wish it were, perhaps. But I do have a nice day job as well. I'm the publishing director of a weekly newspaper about the art market called Antiques Trade Gazette.
Oh, okay. So chess is a sort of extended hobby.
Yes. I mean, I play tournaments and I'm a club player.
Yeah.
But I do a weekly session for high performing juniors at my local club, and I do some one-to-one coaching as well.
Okay. Well, a good question to you would be, you have a lot of students, and they come to you and they say, Matt, I read about Schwyzensuk, but now there is a video, there is an online course, at both at Chessable, and there is a print book. So which of the three should I choose?
Oh, that's a great question. I suppose it depends on your learning style and how you like to take in information. But there are Chessable courses I have where I also end up getting the book as well, because they don't mirror each other one-to-one. When we were discussing with New in Chess what to do with the Chessable course in terms of turning it into a book, we ultimately kind of rewrote quite a lot of it. New puzzles came out, new positions that we wanted to include. And we'd had further ideas as well of other things we could include. And also we got a lot of feedback as well from the Chessable course. People were reading, were playing through the course and then tweeting us positions that they'd had in their games and were able to find the intermediate move as a result of taking the course. So we put a lot of that into the book. So the book kind of takes it one stage further, I suppose.
Yes, certainly. But so that makes it mandatory to buy the book, of course. But is it learning style? Is it that you just look at yourself and see what do I like best? Do I train with repetition? Do I watch a video quite passively, or do I get out my wooden chess set and have a book and a quiet evening? Is it learning style, or?
I think that's part of it. You can also not get out a set and just try and visualize it. That's a very good exercise when you're using a book. But Tasha and I are both regular users of Chessable. We have daily streaks in the hundreds. So, but we both have a decent library of chess books. I don't know about you, Natasha, but I kind of like both systems myself.
Yeah, exactly. And I kind of prefer. Sometimes I it depends what I'm doing. So like if I'm traveling, then I might prefer, like if I'm in an airplane or something like that, then I'm going to want to read a book. Whereas if I'm sitting at my computer, then I might prefer just solving on the screen. So it depends where I am in the day as to what I prefer to do.
Yeah. Okay, Natasha, the Schwyzensuk was also kind of threatened. It is a hidden resource, but it might have got lost because we are playing more online blitz, and there's also the pre-move. Can you explain a bit about that? So,
yeah, exactly. So because everybody's playing chess very fast, and the pre-move can save you some microseconds, then it's very common to think of takes. So when you capture, when someone captures, you recapture. But a lot of our puzzles are about training ourselves to think of another possibility in the position. So sometimes there is a move you can play in between, for example, a check or a threat that gets you an advantage by not just doing the automatic move. And so if you stop and think and don't pre-move, and the book will give you pointers as to when you might want to do that. So the types of pattern you're looking for in your game where there could be the possibility of an intermediate move. Then you maybe don't want to do your pre-move, but make sure you look for those possibilities.
Yeah, because there are some beautiful phrases in the book, like you have to retrain your brain's autopilot.
Yes, exactly.
And also something that I want to quote from the foreword by Michael Adams, the English grandmaster. He says it's immensely satisfying when you ignore the automatic response to find a special alternative instead. Is that something that also made you want to write this book, the beauty of those threes and sooks, the possibilities?
Yeah. So we started looking for these kind of puzzles and then found these patterns that were happening over and again. And then when you're sort of tuned in to look for them, they are very beautiful. And actually, it's a really nice experience in a game to find one that your opponent hasn't spotted. So after we just finished putting the material together, I was playing a game in the European Senior Teams Championships. And I'd spotted like two or three moves ahead this possibility of ignoring my opponent who is lining up a fork on my pieces, but instead just pushing my pawn forward with a threat to promote a kind of in-between move. And it just like even when you're winning a game of chess is exciting normally, but when you can do it with Zwischenzug, it's just, it's really, really fun. And he hadn't seen the move coming and I played it. And you could just see, actually he was a really nice guy, I don't know, but you could see the shock on his face and then eventually he just resigned. But then we were talking about the game, like me and my opponent were talking about the game afterwards it's just really nice to win it that way.
Yeah. How rare are threes and sooks? I mean, a hole in one in golf, it's like a one out of 45,000 experience. Is a threes and sook rare or can you find it?
There are actually really loads. And once you start spotting them, you see them much more often. Actually, Matt and I were watching after we finished writing the course, we were watching the World Championship match between Ding and Nepo. And we were wondering if we'd see any Zwischenzugs there. But then they were happening again and again during that match. And we were messaging each other. And actually, every single theme we thought of in our book appeared in that match. And so there were, I don't know, over 40 in the match. And so, you know, an average of more than one a game, either actually played or just very close to the main sequence, so affecting the sort of course of play. So yeah, really, really common. I mean, there's different styles that have, excuse me, more or less possibilities for Zwischenzugs, but when you put kind of tactical features into your position, you can get games full of them. And now when we play tournaments, there's just very often Zwischenzugs in the games or affecting the course of play at the very least.
Just to expand on that, on Nepo against Ding Liren, it's unbelievable that in one match, what is it, 16 games and four tiebreak rapid games, that they have produced so many threes and sooks. Matt, do you have an explanation? Why on earth can these? Does it happen to these guys? Is that an exception, or is it because of who they are?
Well, I mean, whilst it's a common move, I think that match in particular was a bit special, and Ding in particular didn't go for long lines of opening theory himself. And that just tended to lead to positions that were kind of more of a tactical fight. I mean, Nepo did play some, you know, as white, some long kind of Roy Lopez lines, but outside of that, there was an awful lot of let's get a position and let's play chess. And I think it tends to lead to this sort of outcome that it's going to be very tactical, I mean, Ding played more intermezzos than Nepo did, but Nepo did find some really nice ones himself. And yeah, it's it was 14 rounds and then four rapid plays. But in both formats, there was an awful lot of Zwischenzugs played, threatened. And then if you were watching the commentary, you could see the commentators saying, well, if the game goes this way, there's going to be all these other possibilities as well. So it was just the games were incredibly, incredibly rich. And Sasha was saying, we just finished the chessable course, but we suddenly realized we would need to add another chapter to it to cover this amazing match. And that's found its way into the book as well.
Yeah, it's great. Okay, Natasha, there. I also really liked, what I really liked about the book is that it's beautifully written and that you have looked for phrases that catch the ear. Can you explain why you did that? And can you mention a few?
Yeah, sure. So what we wanted to do was make the patterns we're coming up with easy to remember. So it's aimed at intermediate level player so that they can find them in their own games. And so we picked out a whole lot of patterns that were occurring again and again. And then we came up with names of each pattern to make them memorable. So an example would be connected queens. And that pattern, it happens a lot. It could be queens, rooks or bishops, long range pieces. It could be the pieces lining up against each other with a piece in between that can come out the way. And by moving that piece out of the way, you threaten an attack. And that leads to a lot of the Zwischenzugs we found. Also, if your piece is attacked and the opponent piece is attacked of similar value, we called that mutual emprise. And again, if that situation is there and it's your move, there's an awful lot of chances for making a surprise intermediate move to then just capture their piece that's still emprise. So yeah, we had quite a lot of different... so each pattern that we came up with, we've made a name for it. And that then we found actually, we've had some amateur players who have taken the course and then started finding those patterns in their own games and finding their own intermezzo sequences. And then they're like posting, I found this connected queen's position. And yeah, it's really nice.
Because it does help when you're behind the board and you're thinking about the position. Then if you spot those two queens, it helps if you can say connected queens. Maybe there is something. Is that
sure.
How it works?
And doing, even when I've been doing commentaries online and things like that, then I found I'm now much, much quicker at spotting those kind of positions because it's got a sort of special place in my brain now that if I do see a connected queens pattern, I'm looking out for it and I'm looking out for, are there these possibilities of these tactics? And so it lets me see a bit more in a position or be more familiar with those kind of positions than I was before we started doing the course.
This podcast is brought to you by DGT, the chess innovators. Play on an elegant online chessboard on your favorite chess platforms against old or new friends and without using any screens. You can connect with the DGT app or others, such as the chess.com app. After connecting with an opponent, you can put your phone away and concentrate fully on the board. You will see your opponent's moves through LED rings on the board. To find your nearest DGT dealer, please visit our website at dgt.nl.
Matt, maybe we can do a challenge and do some visualization. I liked the example of the bouncing rooks. Can you explain in blindfold how it works with two connected pawns on the sixth rank? And there was a rook, so the defending party has only one rook and the other has two connected pawns on f6 and g6 and the rook is on g1 and the king is on e5. So let's do it again.
My words.
So two white pawns on f6
yeah.
And g6, the white king on e5, so the king defends the pawn on f6 and the white rook of the black rook is on g1, so the black can take pawn takes g6, but then f7, it will, the pawn will promote because the rook cannot prevent it. So that I thought that's really a beautiful example of a Twissenzug.
Yeah, and so endgames kind of have a whole series of interesting Zwischenzugs that might not occur in other phases of the game, and so we cover this extensively as well. And you'd normally think two connected pawns on the sixth rank against a rook is game over.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, you want to take that pawn, but you don't want to take it immediately, as you've just explained, that loses. So we need to find a move before we capture, and that move would be moving the rook up to check the king. The king moves forward, and then you can capture the pawn. And then f7 isn't possible because the king is now on the sixth rank along with the rook, and so the pawn is pinned. And then you can just trade down into a draw by playing rook takes pawn the next move. So it'd be rook g5, king e6, rook g6. By bouncing the rook onto g5 first, before you play the move you actually want to play, which is rook takes pawn, you give yourself the chance to draw rather than lose what is normally a lost endgame.
Yeah.
There was a very nice bouncing rook in Ding Nepo where the rook was going to go to the open file, but instead, if you go rook to f1 attacking, there was a pawn on f6, then what it meant was that black had to go and defend the pawn. I think it was with the king, and then the rook could bounce to the open file, and it just deflected where the king was, and it just made it a whole lot more powerful for white. So there's this kind of bounce it to somewhere where you don't want to go, but deflect the opponent, and then go back to where you wanted to go.
Yeah, it's really one of the gems in the book. These phrases like connecting queens, connected queens, bouncing rooks, bouncing bishops. It helps you visualize and look for things. Yeah, really nice. For those listeners who it's too difficult to do the visualization, we'll have it in the notes on the website on newinchess.com. Natasha, you are not only a chess player, but you do other mind games as well. Can you tell us some of what other games you're playing?
Yeah, sure. So I play Go and Shogi, and also abstract games. So when I learned Go actually quite a while back, and I played to a good level. I played for England at Go and at chess, and I also played this game Pair Go, where you play with a partner. And this is, it's a really lovely game. I did not though play Shogi until I co-wrote the book Game Changer, which was all about chess and artificial intelligence. And AlphaZero had learnt the games of chess, Go, and Shogi. So I thought, okay, I better learn Shogi as well. So I played all three. And Shogi is an absolute gem. I mean, really wonderful discovery. It's like chess, but every game ends in a tactical sequence, pretty much. Lots of mating patterns, not many draws, and in the level that European Shogi level, you don't have to know openings to quite the same extent that you do in chess. But it's a really beautiful game, and I got absolutely hooked on that. I also play abstract games, so I'm part of the England team. There's a world online championship for abstract games, and it's actually really, really full on. You have four games a month, and you probably will be familiar or know how to play two of them, and you have to learn two new ones. But the people you'll be up against are going to be really strong at those games. So it's, I don't know whether you'd have heard of them, but like Tumbleweed and but things you would have heard of, like Othello, Drafts, then Chess Variants, Chess 960, all these kind of abstract games, Hex and Twix, like connection games, territory games. It's really great fun, actually, because that period when, and I found it a bit, it relates to the book a bit, actually, Zwischenzug, but the period when you're just learning a new game, it's very, very exciting. You're kind of learning strategies of that game and improving quickly, but seeing what's possible and what's not possible. And again, when you're learning those Zwischenzug patterns, it's, you're kind of learning new possibilities in your position. You get familiar with what you can do and what you can't do, and where those possibilities are going to materialize. And so, like, from other games, there's themes that are common across a lot of games, like, I don't know, control of the center, double attacks, very, very common in lots of different games. And also the payoff, and this is particularly in Go, between kind of territory and influence. So the possibilities that you've got compared with, and I guess in chess it's as well, material against the sort of power of your pieces and what they can do. So those themes kind of transfer across games. And we've got actually a section in the book about concepts from Japanese games and how you put these extra possibilities into your position.
Yeah, I wanted to go there because you introduced two phrases that I hope will become more common in the chess world. Like Schwiesenzug was picked up from as a German word. You introduce Aji and Tanuki, if I pronounce them correctly. And they're both from Go. And so let's start with the last one. When in doubt, Tanuki. So what is
Go
it?
Proverb. Yeah. Because when you first start learning, you kind of build up your autopilot, and so you might answer an attack with a defensive move. And sometimes you need to do that. But if something attacks, say a queen attacks your pawn, you defend the pawn, and there's these sort of automatic moves that you play to meet exactly what your opponent's just threatened. But in Go and in chess as well, sometimes you don't want to just defend against the attack they've played. You want to take the initiative elsewhere. And so you might want to play a bigger move or a more threatening move elsewhere in the board. And by doing that, you gain the initiative and the opponent has to take time to defend against the threats that you're building up. So it's a bit like a distraction tactic or playing somewhere else, but it's like an attack is the best form of defense. It's this kind of concept of taking the initiative, playing somewhere else, and making sure you get the big moves and you're kind of driving the agenda there.
Matt, can you explain about Aji, or should we ask Natasha about that one as well?
Well, I'm happy to do it.
Yeah, Aji.
I would certainly defer to Natasha's vastly greater experience of Go than the four times I've ever put down a black or white counter. But Aji is more about latent possibilities in the position, the kind of tension and potential that builds up in order for you then to execute in chess terms, at least potential tactical sequences. It's often better to maintain that tension for a while rather than release it, which is something I think we are familiar with in chess, with, you know, pawns that could capture each other in the center and so on. But Aji is much bigger than that. It can kind of capture all the details on the board of salient points in the position and where the pieces are and what their potential might be. And as a kind of non-Go player, it was interesting for me to kind of absorb this concept and then start thinking about it in the positions that I was facing in my own games. Indeed, I was analyzing one of my games with Natasha, and I played a not particularly good move in the opening, and her comment to me was, well, look at all the Aji in this position, there's so much going on here that if you just moved your pawn forward and gained more space, you'd be so much better off. And kind of light bulb moment about thinking about all the kind of tension and potential in the position and how to make the best of it. But I'm sure Natasha can add to that from her own experience of playing Go.
In Go, what you might do is you might put a stone somewhere in the board. You don't know at the point where you place it that they maybe need to answer it, but there's different ways you can answer it, and you don't know how it's all going to turn out, but you know there's some possibilities later. You'll come back to it at a later point when the game's developed further and you know what you want to do with it. And I think in chess, and like in our examples, you might set up one of those patterns. Say you set up position where you could do, I don't know, the bouncing rooks or a connected queens or something. You might set it up and there actually might not be a tactic there right now, but it's something that's kind of in your favor in the position, which maybe or maybe won't become useful for you later, but it's still good that you've got it. I mean, it applies to all sorts of positional, or tactical features like a pin or a skewer, that sort of thing as well, or they've got a weakness or they've got an undefended piece. But say they've got an undefended piece, you want to make sure they keep having an undefended piece. So you don't want to just attack the piece and drive it to safety. You leave it undefended, and then maybe in two moves time, you can use the fact they've got an undefended piece. It's not kind of guaranteed, but it's still in your favor because it'll give you extra possibilities. And agi is like those little things in the position that are in your favor and that you can build on to make your plans work. And it might not be immediate, but it's sort of kind of in the position and it's working for you.
Yeah, so it's really nice. So agi and tenuki, I hope they will become much more common in chess as well. I know both of you are going to play the senior teams championship, the European one. This one, a colleague of New In Chess is also going there. Some of the listeners might be interested. How do you prepare for a tournament like that? What's your routine? You're both very experienced with also a helicopter view of chess improvement. So what's your routine, Matt, for a tournament?
Yeah, so I played for England the World Senior Teams in 2022. I'm not playing in the next one.
Okay. Yep.
I will think about the openings I want to prepare. If I can look up some opponents in advance and make some notes on what they're likely to do, then I'll do that, because at this level, a lot of those players' games are in the database or online and so on. So I'll spend some time looking at their openings and decide what I might want to play against them. I might put those into Chessable and then, you know, play them through as my repertoire. And then I like to do some tactics as well.
How and where do you do those tactics?
I like chess.com's Puzzle Rush Survival. Mm-hmm. As does Natasha, in fact. And
what's survival? How does it work?
So it's not, you know, Puzzle Rush sounds like it's 2 minutes and you've got to solve as many in 2 minutes, which I don't like so much. Mm-hmm. Survival, you can take as long as you want on each puzzle. And when you get three wrong, then you finish, and however many you've got right is your score.
Okay.
The nice thing about that is there's a leaderboard for who got the most points or the biggest number correct during the past hour, during the past day, or forever. So you can see where you rank against other players on that leaderboard. And it's always nice if you have a good run and you get above some kind of higher rated titled players who are also having a go. That's always a little, feels like a little win.
Okay. And it's also a setting, you can find it on chess.com. When you go to Puzzle Rush, you just look for survival.
That's right. Okay. Yes. Yeah. And but if you get pretty good at it, then you'll need to reserve about 2 hours.
Okay, 2 hours.
go through it. Okay. Like once you get to 50 or 60, then it can take about 2 hours if you're trying to calculate everything out.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Because the level increases.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, okay. The early ones are, you know, back rank mates and all that sort of stuff. Mates in one or two, but then they get a lot more technical. The tactical gain is smaller sometimes, the number of moves and you have to calculate to the end of the line are longer, and okay. Also you're trying to find the refutations that might, you know, scupper what you're doing, and you have to start again.
Okay, so tactics and opening preparation, and then probably general fitness as well.
Yes, go for the odd walk.
Okay. Yeah, no, that's important. Okay, Natasha, what's your pre-tournament routine?
Yeah, so I never have quite as much time as I want to pre-tournament.
Oh, no, with all the shogi and go.
No, and work as well. And so it's kind of what you do, what you can do. But I do always like to have at least the week before to do a Puzzle Rush, so this Puzzle Rush Survival, every day in the run-up to a tournament, because I really think it makes a difference to my tactics.
So that could be 2 hours per day for a week.
Yeah. I will try and do that.
Okay.
And even a little bit of, you know, in the weeks leading up to a tournament, I'll try and make sure I do at least some. And then I've now got into a routine with Chessable to make sure all the lines I'm learning in Chessable, I'm up to date.
Your opening repertoire.
Well, it is opening repertoire, but actually it's also the Zwischenzug course, because I've learnt, because those kind of come up in my training plan as well. So actually that gives me some tactics puzzles too. So opening repertoire and tactics. And then if I can, I try and also learn one new opening line, and it might not be a lot, but it's to make me hope that line appears in one of my games, so it gives it a little bit of an extra tournament as well.
Are you adding to your opening repertoire, or just
adding or patching a hole but I like to be able to play something completely different sometimes to what I've been playing before. And it won't normally be replacing my entire repertoire, just because I won't have time to learn all that. But I will try and get at least a new line in there. And then maybe what I've been doing recently as well is just very gradually is learning a bit of the endings that you're meant to know as well. So just including a bit of end games into it too.
Okay. One last question. As a book publisher, you're always interested in other chess books. So Matt, if someone comes to you, a friend, and he says, "I want a really entertaining but also a really instructive book," what would you, and can't be Zwischenzug, of course. So what other book would you suggest to him?
Oh wow, well, obviously recommend everything Natasha's ever written. But, alongside that, ones I've enjoyed would be for tactics, The Woodpecker Method. Mm-hmm. Axel Smith.
Yep.
I think that's good. Thomas Wilhelm's Chess Toolbox. I think it's very nice. He also uses interesting names for
Thomas Wilhelmsen. Yeah.
Taxi.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. That's so. The Woodpecker is by Quality Chess, and Thomas Wilhelmsen is by Newin Chess. You can find them on the Newin Chess website. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. And Natasha, you already are an award-winning writer. You won both the ECF awards, didn't you? With both books. Yeah. So the Game Changer was with both were
both with Matthew Sadler.
Yeah, both were with Matthew Sadler. Yeah.
Yes, Game Changer and Chess for Life. And one I've enjoyed, I've now forgotten the title of it, but it was written by Mickey Adams and Philip Hurtado, which was looking at the different chess positions and looking at moves kind of amateurs and strong professionals played. And I think that's absolutely excellent book, because then it will give Mickey's analysis of each position afterwards as well.
Think like a super GM.
That's the fascinating thing, like those super GMs like Mickey Adams, but also Caruana and Carlsen, they are so good at explaining, even for club players or post beginners, what they are thinking and how chess could be played. Yeah, it's fascinating. Okay, so Think Like a Super GM and The Toolbox and The Woodpecker Method. Well, thank you very much for this conversation. I'm already looking forward to your next project. That's probably in the making, so we won't ask yet. And for all the listeners, please do send us your feedback by email, podcast@newinchess.com. Dirk-Jan will look back at the candidates tournament next week. And if you have any question about the candidates, please ask him, and he will put your question to the reviewer. And we don't know who that will be yet, because that also depending on who will win the candidates. Natasha, Matt, thank you very much. And your book, Zwischenzug, can be found on the Newin Chess website. And there's always a PDF of about 25 pages of sample pages that you can download and have a look at the wonderful tactical motives that you collected. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Remote.
Thank you.